If you're an HVAC technician and a call comes in, Grainger knows that you need a partner that helps you find the right product, fast and hassle-free. And you know that when the first problem of the day is a clanking blower motor, there's no need to break a sweat. With Grainger's easy-to-use website and product details, you're confident you'll soon have everything humming right along. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey everybody, it's Mark Pattison. I'm back again with another great episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. We find ourselves right now on Mount Everest Base Camp. It's an incredible experience. It's been incredible so far. Came over here on April 1st, and now we're in the second week of May when this is being broadcast. But we're talking today to a remarkable man, Tom French. We're going to get to him in just a minute. If anybody wants to follow the journey, you can do that at www.markpattisonnfl.com. You can follow the blog, which I'm trying to give every other day updates on what's going on. And there's also a Garmin app. And if you hit the button, follow the journey, you can actually see us going up and down the mountain, which is pretty cool. As always, we continue to fundraise for Amelia's Everest, the Lhotse Challenge. My daughter has epilepsy, and we've combined with the organization in Sun Valley, New York, and Los Angeles called Higher Ground. Great organization, been super supportive, and very grateful for all those who have actually donated to this cause. Hopefully, people like my daughter who have epilepsy since she was 8, she's now 22, will one day be cured of that. So on with the podcast. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark.
Hey, listen, so I want to give some context of what's going on. So you and I were climbing mates. So it's a lot like when we come from all parts of the country. You happen to come from Boston, and you had come with your son, Will, at the time. And we end up, of all places, Antarctica, right? And none of us know each other. And by the end of it, you know, we all become best friends in some capacity at some level. And we had a really successful outing. I think we had a really good team, just like today. But what I'm trying to do is help educate people who have not done this adventure travel, where you pick a spot on the map, you go find an expedition leader. In our case, it was Alpine Ascents. Our leader was Vern Tejas. And then we end up in these foreign countries and these remote places, the tip of Chile originally, before we got on the plane and flew over. And what has that been like for you in terms of like stepping into something that you're not familiar with? You're very accomplished, private equity on the East Coast. I know you sail quite a bit and you've done some other things, but you know, we talked to somebody this last week, Bex Ferry, and she was talking about being a role model of five kids. In your case, I think you've got three, but Will certainly was the one kid that you had along with that. But let's go back to kind of the beginning. Like, how did you get drawn into the whole world of adventure travel?
Wow. I guess there's adventure travel and there's climbing, and the two sort of go together.
Yeah.
I got drawn into climbing as a kid. My father owned an outdoor sports and mountaineering store. He had a good friend named Willie Unsold, who turned out he was the first American and first guy up the West Ridge of Everest, actually.
And wow.
Guy who taught me how to rock climb when I was 8 years old. And I idolized the guy. So that sort of got me into climbing way back when. And then my life went some other places. And then I found myself able to come back to it. My son, Will, dragged me back into it. So that was a little bit me getting into climbing early and then getting back to it. And then there's the whole adventure travel. I don't know if you and I ever talked about it. I led expedition tours and cruises for 3 years all over the world when I got out of college.
No kidding. So,
and when I wasn't leading them, I was just throwing a backpack on and, you know, kind of going all over the place. Paddled six rivers here in Nepal back in 1982 as an example, and a bunch of other things, kayaking. So that's a lot. Anyway, so there's sort of two themes for me, adventure travel, and you're right, they kind of go together, going to some amazing place and having a reason to be there and do it. And I love that. I've loved that my whole life. And there's climbing. And I love that whole. And kind of in both cases, I probably did both of those pretty intensely till I was about 25, 6, 7, 8. And then I kind of went off and had a career and I had a family and did a lot less of that. And woke up a few years ago and realized I could do more of it. So a little bit long-winded way of saying they're coming back together. And I've been doing a bunch of climbing the last 3 or 4 years. Had that wonderful experience with you in Antarctica. And the two do come together. In fact, I remember landing in Punta Arenas at the airport, my son Will and I, and You were on the plane. That's the first time I met you. Was picking up our North Face duffels there, and heading to the. So I don't know if that answers the question.
It does, and it, you know, it's just kind of like you're influenced by certain events that happen in your life, and you know, it comes full circle. And the wonderful thing about that is, again, earlier in your life, past 20, you're in Nepal, you're guiding down different rivers, and now, you know, fast forward the clock 30 years, you've got your kid Will, who I think was maybe going to Dartmouth or something.
Yeah, he's graduating. He
had come down there and he was kind of following your steps in a different way, but still that's that zest for life of getting after things and not being afraid to go after it.
Yeah, totally. And it's been fun to watch him. He's become really quite a climber on his own right, pretty good ice climber. And he's teaching me some things now, a lot of things now, particularly about that. But it all came together. And I think if I think about Vincent, that was a climb that came together. And to your point, there's this whole thing about becoming part of a team and a climbing team and what that's all about. And there's an adventure. There's a go to a place and something. And I think Antarctica really was that for me.
Yeah.
I equally wanted to climb a mountain I hadn't climbed, and I wanted to go to Antarctica. Yeah. I just wanted to go there and be there. And I thought the thing about Vincent was both 0 to 10 scale, 10 out of 10. Well, just the experience of going to Antarctica blew my mind. And it was a great climb. And then, as you've alluded to, there's this whole thing about a group, who you're with and who you share it with. And you can get lots of different outcomes there. I thought we had an unbelievable outcome. And sharing that with my son was really special. I've climbed a few things with him, but I yanked him out of school a little bit, and he knew I was paying, so he was willing to come on down to Antarctica. And that was just an amazing experience.
I think when you do have an amazing experiences like that, you also have to prepare yourself, right? And you have to put yourself in that position, because it's not, you don't just wake up and walk out the door and say, hey, I'm going to go climb this big mountain. And what we found in Antarctica is that there was a couple people that hadn't done that, hadn't put in the work. And I think it's very transformative in life. You've been very successful in private equity and other things like that. And you didn't just graduate and then you were, you know, on top of the mountain, you know, overnight. It took you years and years and years to kind of build up to that. And just like mountain climbing, you know, you got to put in the work if you want to have the results. And unfortunately, we had a couple of people down there that hadn't put in the work and just kind of checked in. And in one of the cases, we've got one of our climbing mates sitting on top of the mountain right now here in Mount Everest.
Yeah, we may well be walking right by him on summit day.
And you know, the I think the key part about that, that if you go back to that WhatsApp chat room that we had, and your son bravely said, even though he was 21, 22 at the time, I wish somebody would have stood up to him and said something. And it had, at the end of the day, it was a fatal, you know, consequence when he got up here and he got stuck in that big line that we've all now seen. And he's up there 18 hours later. And, you know, it's just tragic in terms of the way that all played out.
Yeah, and, you know, I think you and I are of similar minds here. There's a spectrum of how people approach these things. I think you and I are kind of in the minds that we work incredibly hard at getting ready for this. And, you know, it's a multi-year commitment, and it's a multi-year commitment to getting our bodies and our minds right as 100% of where they can be. That's how I've approached this. I used to be a competitive cross-country ski racer, and I've approached this just that way, which is it's full-on getting ready on every dimension. Yeah. I know you do exactly the same thing, and you and I both know not everybody does. Yeah. We witnessed that on Vincent. That's, you know, that's clearly the case here. And, you know, there's a spectrum of people that are on the mountain, I think, of abilities and commitment to getting ready. And you and I, we're preaching to the choir, but I believe I've gotten myself as absolutely ready as I can be at age 61, you know, and I think you've gotten yourself absolutely as ready as you can be.
At age 59.
You know,
so right up there, yeah. But I think there's kind of an overreaching, you know, statement in life about preparation. Preparation meets opportunity, right? And so we're talking about this tragic event that happened 2 years ago up here. But, you know, in terms of you may not always know the outcome, and X doesn't always equal Y. But if you do X, you're going to put yourself in the best position to achieve Y.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. You know, we don't control all the variables on a mountain, on this mountain, but we sure control, we control a lot of inputs, to your point. And it reminds me of an expression somebody used in a different context, business, which was you make your own luck. I mean, people who got really successful, we actually studied what is it that caused them to be really successful. And they all kept going, I was just lucky. I was just lucky. And for some reason I said, it can't be that everybody's just lucky. There's a little bit like you make your own luck, which I think is what you're saying. And not 100%, but I do think you make your own luck. And I think you make your own luck in climbing. Doesn't mean you get 100% of the outcome you want. You don't control everything. But yeah.
So I use this saying quite often, success leaves clues, right? And so kind of to your point, if you go look at the most successful people out there, they do certain things in a certain way that leaves those clues. And if you start to follow them versus just invent your own way, you can maybe not have their success like Bill Gates or something, but you can certainly, there's a pattern, right, of attributes and things that they do, of books they read, of the time that they get up, of the discipline in life that they have, the commitment they have towards that certain discipline, that goal that they have, that can, again, put them in the best position of success to get there. You know, you and I are Facebook friends, and even though I'm on one coast and you're on the other, we follow each other on Facebook, and I'm constantly seeing you on Mount Washington or other places that challenging yourself and putting yourself in that position to be successful in a mountain and an environment like Mount Everest.
Yeah, no, and I was thinking both about mountains and about life in general, as you're alluding to. So how do you make your own luck? I guess there's, on the one hand, you have a goal, and then you just 100% prepare for it and 100% commit to it and 100% work toward it. And then in my mind, the second thing is, and then when suddenly there's a little bit of a 30-degree course correction, you just go with it. I mean, it's like resets. Like, I think we all have resets. And I think you're asking, okay, so how does it work for people? I think it's got the goal, work like mad for the goal. And then when there's a reset on whatever dimension that is, okay, now you got the reset and okay, alter the goal. What's the new goal? Go. You know what I mean? I think we've all lived that in the last year in one shape or form. But yeah, certainly for me, for climbing, I've set some goals and gone 100% at them. And then when something's changed, I've said, okay, well, all right, what's the new one? And let me go, you know.
There's a lot of type A personalities here, a lot of people with a lot of success, right? And as I like to tell other people, you know, I've been fortunate in a lot of different ways, but I've also put myself in those positions, the NFL, Sports Illustrated, climbing these different mountains around the world. And the only difference, maybe not everybody can play in the NFL, but, you know, they can achieve high levels at whatever thing that they go after. And a lot of times at the end of the day, it's just that I don't quit every single day, get up and show up, right? And that's half the battle, is just showing up.
Yeah, so true. And there's intermediate steps, you're right, and sort of just knocking off the intermediate steps. Yeah, amen.
So I had this interesting conversation with our last week's guest, and I asked the question, you know, so what's next? And he said the right thing down there, Kevin, watching you. And he said something brilliant, which was, and I'm going to ask you the same question, and the question was, so what's next, right? And his answer, and I kind of filled it in as well, which is kind of one game at a time. So not necessarily looking like I'm going to go sail around the world, or I'm going to go take on the Boston Marathon or something, but do you have a what's next? How does your mind work around that? Or are you just focused on the main goal right now?
And, I do have a what's next, and I don't know what's next. So I had a 33-year career, which I, you know, retired as I planned when I turned.
Well, I thought this was a sabbatical stuff.
Well, it sort of is, because I called it a gap year originally. I said I want to take a year or two and do a bunch of things that I haven't been able to do for a while, and that was climb a bunch of mountains, ski in some master ski races, sail our sailboat further than I've been able to sail our sailboat, and I'm kind of nearing the end of the – and I therefore said, okay, I'm going to – postpone some business opportunities I have, some other things I have, some board opportunities I have, and I'm just going to go do that. And so now I'm kind of nearing the end of the gap year, having done most of that. It was a little blown up by COVID, but not completely, reset a little bit. And I'm kind of, when I get home from this, it's the end of what I rebranded a gap year and a half, and now I got to decide what's next. And one problem is I'm having so damn much fun on my gap year. I got to figure out what the right mix is. And for me, it's going to be a mix of some business opportunities and some boards I'm going to serve on, but not 100% stopping what I've been doing for the last year and a half, which has been working out like a madman and skiing some ski marathons and climbing some mountains. And I've loved every minute of it. So now I got to figure out what the right mix is of all that. And it's going to be a mix.
Yeah. You know, the one thing that's interesting to me is like, what is that combination, right? And so many people are at their work, right? Financial services or something. And you're looking out the window and go, God, it's such a beautiful day. I wish I could go skiing or go running or go this or that. And then you get that freedom and then you don't go do it. right? So it's the commitment to also, once you're retired and you have that free time, to go into actually make these things happen, because there's no deadline. There's nobody over your shoulder saying, you got to have this report in by 5 o'clock.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess absolutely. So far, that has been easy for me because there have been these goals. I'm going to climb this mountain. I'm going to get ready for those ski races or whatever else. I think it's going to be interesting. I'm going to sort of reset what the goals are.
Yeah.
And maybe to me, somebody described it this way. It's like, I'm going to have a portfolio of things I want to do. So it's like any portfolio, they're different asset classes, you know, and okay, well, you know, what's the mix of asset classes you want to be in? And that's a little bit how I'm thinking about it, which is, all right, I know I'm going to do a bunch of climbing and a bunch of ski racing and a bunch of outdoor stuff. That's one asset class. Call that one.
Yeah.
I'm going to do some community service. Okay. I'm going to do some early stage investing. I'm going to serve on some boards.
Yeah.
Now at least I know what the asset classes are.
Yeah.
I think it's okay to, it's okay to reset the portfolio on a yearly basis. I don't think I have to know. I mean, I can pick the mix for a year. I can run the play for a year and I can reallocate.
Yeah.
Not to sound like a business person, but that's kind of how I'm thinking about it.
Well, that's what you are. And I like the way your mind works in that way. And I think when you look at it that way, it helps you like keep it balanced and keep you focused and keep you life interesting, right? Because you're not just lopsided or topsided on one particular thing that you're doing, and then you burn out and they're like, okay, now what? You're really mixing your interest around the board. So let's talk about this episode is being broadcast in mid-May. We're talking mid-April. We've already been up here in the country, the great country of Nepal. We've been basically following each other all the way up the mountain. I think you've been a day or two ahead of us. You're with Alpine Ascents. What has this international community, this village, if you want to call it, here at Everest Base Camp? We're at 17,500 feet. What has it been like for you so far?
Yeah, so several things. You hear about that always when you hear about climbing. You always hear about Everest Base Camp. And you talk to people who've been here and people come back again and again and again. And they always talk about how special it is. And I got to say, it has been every bit as special as people say it is.
Yeah.
And in my mind, probably better. I don't know why. I mean, maybe a little jaded. I just thought, okay, I get it. But a little bit of a circus and you can imagine some of that. And I have felt a combination of probably more extreme physical beauty even than I expected, just the physical location of it, an orderliness to it. This doesn't feel like some kind of crazy overcrowded place with a bunch of weird stuff going on. It feels incredibly well in its own way, organized in this beautiful place. And then, of course, you've got this flow of people from all over the world who share the ultimate common denominator, you know, which is both interests and passion and then a specific goal. Mm-hmm. And I'm just loving it. I mean, you know, just interacting with people. I think I probably thought I would, but maybe even more so than I thought I would. And the other thing I don't lay over that, and I know you're into it as well, the whole trek in, the interplay as one comes here with the country and the Nepali culture and specifically the Sherpa culture. I was here in the early 80s a bunch and kind of back in the early 90s a bunch, and I kind of didn't know what it was going to feel like to come back. And I really didn't know how – I just didn't know. And I was prepared to think that it wasn't as special as it felt to me back in the early 80s. And it has felt every bit as special to me. And that's been a joy. So for me, I guess I've lived two things. I've lived trekking in here and loving and just rejoicing in the Sherpa culture and Nepal as a country and all that. And then getting here to base camp, and then you sort of shift gears a little bit, and you're in this international community, this international climbing community. But we're just lucky to, I think, be a part of it.
Yeah.
It's
so we are literally yards. I don't know. I mean, I can throw a football and literally hit the ice fall. I mean, it's that close. You know, I'm talking about the edge of it, not the core of it. But you know, I've been so blown away about how long this thing is that we got to like traverse through and navigate. That certainly is one element. But the other element, and I think I was talking about it with my buddy Ronan over here from Ireland. And, you know, if you go back in time and you see these black and white pictures with these guys up here at 17,500 in tweed suits, and there was no North Face, right? There was no OR. There was no Mountain Hardware, these types of companies. And they're looking at this flipping ice fall, right, that we got to navigate and go through. Like, what the hell were the things? I mean, like, how is this even going to happen, right?
Yeah, totally. And do it all themselves. They had to fix the ropes. They had to find the route, and they had to get all their, you know, do the whole thing themselves, as opposed to having some infrastructure in place, which we're fortunate to draft off of.
Well, so let's go back into something you said just a couple minutes ago. And I said, but the question was like, how's your experience been so far? And you said, oh, it's been just amazing for the last 2 weeks. We've been trekking all. And as you go up the valley of the Kumba, there are all these different villages, is probably a strong word. I'm not even sure what you call them, but these structures where there's these tea huts and you stay, they feed you. And it's this wonderful experience. Some are a little bit bigger than others in terms of having some other infrastructure. But again, going back in the day, like, it's just like spin the bottle, which way do you want to go? And we think it's that way, right? But you don't have this exact path with the trail that you and I both climbed. And then one of the reasons too, for people that don't know, why we did it this way is to get our red blood cell count up. I think we flew in at, what, Lucla 7,500, something like that?
Higher than that, maybe 12. No, yeah, almost 12, 11, 12.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah, close to that.
Whatever it is, it doesn't matter.
No,
it was
high.
Yeah, but the whole key was trying to acclimate and put your body in the best position so that we're living here now at 17.5, you know, for the next month, and that you're not sick. We've already had some team members, you know, come down with some different things. One gal was flown down the mountain yesterday, just can't get over it, you know, that awful mountain sickness. And if you don't prepare yourself, but again, I'm going back to in time and history, back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, I'm sure you're a historical buff, and just like the impossibility dream. And like you said, now that you've got this infrastructure put in place, that it makes it possible and not like a Hail Mary, that we have at least a half a chance to try to make it to the top and back.
Yeah. And by the way, I think it was 9.5 now that I'm sitting here thinking. I think Lucla was more like that because you go down. Not that it matters. The other thing, to your point, you know, these guys, when they came in the early expeditions, they started walking in Kathmandu, which I just think is cool too. I mean, that there was no Lucla to fly into. There was no road to Jiri. So, their approach was twice the length of our approach. They walked 2 or 3 weeks before they could even see the mountain.
So go back and just explain to the audience like what that means. So when we, in terms of the path, so you fly from wherever you're from, in your case, Boston. In my case, I flew from LAX. But tell me what happens, the chronological order of how that happens before we land in this little place called Lucla.
For us now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you throw yourself on a plane and you get yourself to Kathmandu, however you get yourself to Kathmandu.
Yeah.
And then you get yourself organized there. And that's a little trickier this year, given, you know, some of the requirements about COVID and everything else. But you meet your team, you get your gear organized, you figure out what you have. The people you're climbing with figure out how to get a whole bunch of gear directly to base camp and a whole bunch of other gear directly to wherever it is that you're going to get to start the trek in. You know, then finally you figure out, and typically what you do and what you did and what I did and what we've all did is fly into Lucla. And you really have two choices today. And the one most people do is get on this tiny little plane and fly into this tiny little airstrip, you know, up on the side of this, you know, this semi-cliff. And that's the typical play. And then you start trekking from there, which takes plus or minus 11 days, taking breaks to acclimatize. You can these days, and when I was last here with my wife Jill in 1990, we drove as far as you could drive from Kathmandu, which was to a town called Jiri, and started walking from there. And that meant we walked for maybe 6 days before we got to Lucla.
Oh,
you
wow.
know, and, you know, just it was that we were trying to, you know, get a little more trekking in first. But either way, you're basically getting yourself to Kathmandu, getting organized, getting on a tiny little plane, landing on a tiny little airstrip, and then starting the trek that you and I have just done.
I'm asking you, this is kind of the gun-loaded questions because it's not really fair to you, but how is your... So I'm currently climbing right now with Madison Mountaineering, and you're climbing with Alpine Ascents. You and I both had a great experience with Alpine Ascents. Actually, I had on Denali and on Vincent. You decided to continue on with Alpine. How is it going over there with that group?
You know, really well. And they're a class act, just like Madison's a class act.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are a lot of close ties between those two organizations and a lot of mutual respect between Madison and Alpine Ascents. And they've all worked together through the years. So I think we're getting, you and I, both equally high caliber experiences in all the dimensions. You and I talked a lot about this and thought a lot about this and thought about who we wanted to climb with and knew we had one shot at it. But so I'll say it's been great on every dimension. I mean, Ben Jones is a really good expedition leader. The infrastructure around him in Alpine Ascents is top notch, and we've got a good team, people I like. And it's been everything I hoped it would be.
Is it an international group that you have, a lot like ours, or is it more American-based?
Yeah, more American-based. This year, they come and go that way. They've had years in the past that are quite different. I'm trying to think if it isn't – this is on the spot. Like, I might miss somebody, but we are seven summit climbers, of which – all seven, am I missing anybody, are Americans this year, which is unusual for them. Unusual for them.
Yeah, I think we've got 11 or 13 climbers altogether, something, 13, yeah. And, you know, we've got people from all over the place, probably, you know, more Americans than, but, you know, Irish, Canadian, Britain, you know, the whole range. So, and it's cool, Norway. It's fun to have that community, you know, all come together with a common goal and purpose.
Yeah, and I'm sure, as you've done and you always do, you spend early days also figuring out who you're with and what your group's like. And, you know, you got to assume it's going to be a pretty good group of like-minded people. But as you and I know, you do get differences. And I think and the vibe matters and the sort of mutual respect matters and just sort of how it's all going to work as a team matters. And, I think I'm feeling pretty good about that.
Yeah, I mean, we still have a long haul to go. And again, we're what, 5-6 weeks out as we're recording this. When this will broadcast, we'll be probably 2 weeks out, something like that. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, people ask the question, you know, who in their whacked out minds actually wants to go climb this crazy mountain? And it turns out that there's a lot of whacked out people like you and me and the others in this room here at Everspace Camp. They have a common goal that go way beyond just the ego of standing on the tallest mountain in the world. It's the goals, the challenge, those different things that I think drive us all and you know, get us out of bed to keep pursuing. Going back again, 2019, January, we were down in Vinson. We climbed it successfully. We had a great outcome. And then we were ramping up for 2020. And then COVID happened, right? And then it just basically froze the world. And we were like, I mean, I don't know, 10 days in March 2020 or something before we were going to launch to come over to land in Kathmandu around the 1st of April. And then it was like, now what? What was that like for you when we all got that essentially that same call, which is this thing is shutting down and you're not going anywhere?
Man, so I'll tell you, I like all of us probably, I'll never forget it. I completed my last interval hill climb with a 60-pound pack on, you know, that literally, like, the behind our house, this big hill, but you know, just crushed it, came down feeling so good, said, that's the last one of those, I'm ready to go. Got the news literally like an hour and a half later. It felt like somebody punched me in the gut. You know, it was like, I can't believe this. And what I do remember is, you know, it's all right, I got to do a little reset here. What's the reset here? And I think you were the first person of all the people I knew who were planning on going. I remember you said, like, you were right out of the chute and you said, I'm going next. It's a reset. I'm there in a year. Yeah. You know, this doesn't change anything. It just changes a year. And it actually influenced me because you went there so fast. Yeah. It was just like, this doesn't change anything. And I got there pretty quickly too, but you almost helped me get there, which is,
thank you.
You know, which was,
Yeah, no, I, you know, to say I wasn't bummed, I was, you know, for the first 24, 48 hours. And then after that, I turned it into an opportunity. And it played out that way. I kind of reinvented my workout schedule. I skinned up the mountain 45 times, you know, over 150,000 vertical feet. This, and I think I'd only gone up 33 times the year before. So it was like, okay, how can, maybe this was all meant to be, and usually these things are, right? For silly reasons. At the time, they seem like, why me, or how did this happen, or whatever. But in time, it all plays out. I feel bigger. I feel stronger. I feel more confident about the task at hand. And again, putting yourself in the best position of success way more so than the following year.
You know, and also it goes back to something we talked about earlier in the conversation, which is this idea of resets and goals.
Yeah.
Like, to me, the moment there was this reset and then there was this new goal, there was power in it because you had a new goal. All right, that's where I'm headed. I got to stay in as good shape and, if anything, get myself in better shape. And the moment I had that structure, frankly, it got me through the whole year with all the other stuff falling apart all around us. The moment I locked in on that, you know, I knew where I was headed, and it kind of helped with a lot of things.
You know, I love the word that you just said, power, the power in that. And again, at the time, you know, it's a crisis and the world's falling and all that kind of stuff. And you know, I fast forward the clock, you know, a year, we reset my daughter's goal, Amelia's Everest Lucy Challenge. That was one. So we've raised now, it totaled probably $150,000 for that organization. Number two, is I decided to double down and take on Lhotse as well. So that was new. So that was a new challenge. Like, how could you reinvent your goal that you thought was the ultimate goal? And then NFL Films came along and said, we want to do a documentary on this whole journey, which, you know, would have never happened this next year. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know, it's not all about you. And sometimes, you know, the world works in mysterious ways and is sad and awful and tragic in many ways. COVID hit many people. I think in my case, and probably your case, it turned out to be a blessing and some great things have come out of it.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Yeah, on all those dimensions.
Yeah. So,
in fact, I'm kind of in a weird way gladder I'm here now with the year I just had than if it had happened the way I was hoping it would happen a year ago.
Yeah.
A lot of good stuff's happened in the last year.
Yeah, I mean, it's just weird that I think it's a life lesson about not trying to control everything, being present, and sometimes like the real reason things happen. You're not going to be, those answers aren't going to be revealed. Maybe it's 5 years, 2 years, 10 years. That's not the point. The point is, what are you going to do about it in that moment in time?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And also, this whole phrase, it's as much the journey as it is the destination. And I think so much of that is true in all these things we're doing here. So to me, as much of the power, again, to me, has been getting ready. And that includes the journey of getting to the summit, frankly. Yeah. I mean, I think there's so much power in the process of getting there and preparing and how you get ready and how you put yourself in position, you know, and which is what we're all doing.
No, you're exactly right. And it's given everybody's got their own story, right? And we're now, there's what, 300 permits or something
that
are out there, plus or minus, and everybody's got their own story and how they got here and why they got here and what the motivation and the drive, and there's just a whole lot of really cool stories on how this whole thing has played out. And I think at the end of the day, you know, there's a lot of joy and happiness that, hey, we're back in the game, right, after being put on the sideline for the last year.
Yeah, all of those climbers and all of those supporting, too. If you think about the whole Sherpa community and all the guiding community and all the people who make their living off of this, who had that totally blown up, that are now back in the game, which is huge.
You know what? You're so right, and I'm glad you brought that up. And something that I saw, I brought a football, right? And I did this on Kilimanjaro as well, and I'm out here playing catch with the Sherpa, and not only is it joy and happiness for them to be employed again, and many of them, this is their main gig, and so we can support that in that effort, but out there throwing the ball, just things you and I did when we were 6-7 years old, and the joy and happiness of catching a ball, they have no clue how to throw, you know, like a baseball or in this case a football, but teaching them that, and just like that for that, you know, 5 minutes or 10 minutes of them taking back to when they were a little kid on how you do things like that. You know, the most simple things in life of that joy and happiness is really cool.
And they got the A-team in terms of instructors, too.
Yeah.
They probably didn't even know that.
Yeah, no, I know. Well, listen, continued success in everything that you're doing, number one. Number two, I know we're neighbors now. You're just up the street, I think, here in this little village of Base Camp, Everest Base Camp. And number three, you know, I hope that somehow or another our paths land like we did in Vincent, Massif, at the same time on the summit, and I can give you a hug and high five, and, you know, off we go and safely get back down the mountain.
And the same. Great to be here with you, Mark. I mean, here on the mountain.
Absolutely.
And I look forward to being on the mountain with you.
All right, buddy. Here he is, the one, the only Tom French. Thank you so much.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.
As a quarterback, I love sports. But sometimes when I get hit on my blind side, front side, and put on my backside, I wonder, is Sport Clips better than sports? Because Sport Clips haircuts is sports on TV, plus a relaxing haircut, hot steam towel, and massaging shampoo. Which is better than sports plus... Sport Clips. It's a game changer. Check in online at sportclips.com.